Tomatoes, beans, and avocados all sprout from the rocky South Florida soil, along with one of the largest nursery industries growing trees, shrubs, and other landscaping plants. Add it all up, and it's a multi-billion dollar per year industry for the local economy. I'm Tom Hudson. Coming up on the Sunshine Economy, Grow, the agriculture industry in South Florida. It's a business squeezed by population growth and the desire for cheap food. The dividing line between urban sprawl and rural commerce is clear. That line does not stop cheap imports, though, from flooding the market, igniting an international trade war over tomatoes. And we put Florida's avocados to the taste test. It's all ahead on the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. Not exactly a pleasant sound. Fingernails across a chalkboard is how one farmer describes it. It's the sound of one of the founding industries here in South Florida, a tractor dragging a disc harrow behind it, plowing through the rocky soil of South Florida, essentially crushed limestone. This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Grow, the agriculture industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. South Florida farmers are getting ready for another growing season. It may be harvest time up north, but here in the Sunshine State, when the harvest comes in up north, farmers down here get ready to plant again. Squash, green beans, tomatoes, or tomatoes. Which do you say?
Tomatoes.
Tomatoes.
Heirloom tomatoes.
Tomatoes.
Tomato.
That last person is Tony Damari. He's vice president of his family's produce company, Damari Company. It's a big player in South Florida tomatoes and also has farms in California and South Carolina. That red fruit, that Florida-grown tomato, is awfully important to the Sunshine State and its agriculture industry. In the winter, Florida-grown tomatoes account for almost all U.S.-grown tomatoes. It's also at the center of an international trade war that has been quietly raging for more than a decade. Last year's South Florida tomato crop was very good and good quality, but prices were terrible.
Prices were not very good, and that was primarily because of the volume in imports coming from Mexico at the same time.
That's been the case since the North American Free Trade Agreement was implemented back in the mid-1990s. Between January and April, Florida used to have the U.S. tomato market, but after NAFTA, the volume of those Mexican tomatoes has continued to increase. This is a fight over money. The Florida growers and tomato farmers from other states contend Mexico has been dumping its crop in the U.S. at below market costs. So since 1996, the U.S. Commerce Department has, every few years, negotiated a minimum price with the Mexican growers. The latest deal was signed back in March of this year. It sets the lowest price possible for Mexican-grown field tomatoes sold during the Florida tomato season at 31 cents per pound.
Our cost of production is about $10 a box. That's our picking and packing, harvesting and, growing costs, transportation.
That's $10 per 25-pound box, 40 cents per pound. That's what Tony Damari says is his cost to grow, pick, and pack a South Florida tomato. Meantime, the U.S. government says Mexico can sell its tomatoes for as low as 31 cents per pound.
Tomato crop is one of the most, or one of the highest valued crops in ag, especially in row crop ag. Our costs have escalated tremendously, particularly in the last 7 or 8 years with increase of fuel costs, and so much of what we use as inputs, the derivatives of what we use in our crops, such as fertilizer, some of the chemicals, fungicides that we use to spray the crops for pest and disease, are all tied to oil prices and petroleum, and as a result, our costs have escalated tremendously over that period of time, and over probably the last 10 years or so, Tom, our costs have gone from about $5,000-$6,000 an acre to up to about in excess of $10,000 an acre. At the same time, we're not getting any more money for our product, as we have historically. And part of the reason is because of the influx of volume coming from Mexico. We used to have probably 300 growers throughout the state of Florida. And I'd say that number is less than 30. And of that 30, there's probably 10 major growers that are left in our industry anymore. So you can see the shrinking numbers, and a lot of it's been a direct correlation in the implementation of NAFTA.
The North American Free Trade Agreement was supposed to open up trade, obviously, between Mexico, the United States, and Canada, those three locations. And you go to a Miami or Fort Lauderdale grocery store today, you can find tomatoes from Canada. You go there in January, and you can find tomatoes from Mexico. Can you find Florida tomatoes in Mexico and Canada? Conversely, Tony, are you selling overseas?
We are not selling into Mexico. It's impossible to compete into Mexico or with Mexico during their production season. Canada is a market that we have always sold into. However, with their expansion in the greenhouse industry, we have lost a share of market in Canada as a result. That percentage of market share that we command anymore is a very small share, because Canada produces their own product, and obviously they have transportation advantages over growers in Florida and elsewhere around the United States that are in production at the same time that Canada produces.
Tony, let me ask you to respond to some criticism of the Florida grower that's been leveled on the part of Mexican growers. There was a spokesman for a Mexican tomato industry that told the media recently, quote, "Florida has not evolved. They've become irrelevant in the marketplace," essentially criticizing, Tony, your operation and other operations for the lack of technological innovation to keep pace with the global marketplace. How do you respond?
I dispute that. And the facts are that we have, as producers, continually advanced technologically through drip irrigation from open field, open ditch irrigation, which has allowed us to not only conserve the water usage and therefore enhancing sustainability to our farming operations, but also lessen the impact to the environment. When you are a trading partner such as Mexico and you're importing your product into a country, in this case, it's obviously the United States, regardless of that product, whether it's tomatoes, citrus, automobiles, you cannot sell into that competing country, that trading partner, less than what it costs you to produce. That is called dumping. That's selling below your cost of production. Trade laws are in place, have been in place to protect those industries from foreign countries taking advantage of market opportunities and underselling and selling below their cost of production.
You continue to file a lawsuit, fight for the lawsuit, and in fact, fighting even the Commerce Department's latest agreement with the Mexican growers that the minimum so-called reference price, that minimum floor price that tomato growers in Mexico can charge for their fruit here in the United States, still remains too low.
That's correct. So 95, we filed the suit. We won a favorable ruling before the ITC that, in fact, dumping was found to have occurred by the Mexican producers at a 17% margin.
The ITC is the International Trade Commission. So essentially that the Mexican grower was selling their tomatoes at least 17% below the cost of producing them.
That's exactly what it equates to. So what the Commerce Department did is they stepped in. Instead of following through with the dumping action, they negotiated with the Mexican growers a suspension agreement, suspending that dumping action, and established minimum reference prices. And I think back at the time, it was around 20 cents a pound.
I think it's
or
up
so.
In the mid-30s now, correct?
That's correct. It went from 21, I think, and a half cents a pound to currently 31 cents a pound on open field tomatoes.
Right. And I know, Tony, we're getting way out into the real details of this, but this is where your business really hits the road. I mean, this is it. Tony, when you're talking about a $10 cost for a, 10 or 15 pound box of tomatoes out of South Florida?
25 pound box,
$10 cost. What you're looking at is the cost per pound. And what you continue to contend is that 31 cents per pound that Mexico has as a minimum price is still too low.
What was established in the new agreement that took place that went in effect in March this past year was that the Commerce Department created four separate tomato categories. The 31 cents a pound that you referred to is for open field production and crude low-tech shade house production.
The tomato that comes out of South Dade that's got your company's name on it, do you consider that an open field competitor to Mexico?
No, it's open field. We're an open field producer.
So you're competing at 31 cents per pound, the minimum price that the Mexican tomato can charge here in the United States. Your cost, based upon the details you gave us earlier, is about 40 cents
per pound. That's correct. And remember this, what it costs us here to produce in the United States has no relevancy to what the cost of production is in Mexico. Again, the suspension agreement, the trade laws are in place and state basically that any importer, whether it's a Mexican tomato producer or a producer in Spain for that matter, exporting product in the United States, they cannot sell below those thresholds. And if they do, that is considered dumping. And the trade laws are in place to protect the domestic industry from the competing exporting countries from selling below and therefore eventually knocking out the industry. It would, Tom, it would be no different if the roles were reversed. We had the ability to sell our product into Mexico, sold them less than 40 cents a pound. You can rest assured there'd be a challenge tomorrow by the Mexican producers that the U.S. fresh tomato industry was dumping their product into Mexico. It works both ways.
That's Tony DiMari of DiMari Companies operating here in South Florida, fighting against the rising tide of Mexican tomatoes, eating away the market of South Florida tomatoes and farmers. You can see details of the Department of Commerce deal with Mexican tomato growers. It is in our live chat right now at WLRN.org. And join the conversation on Twitter. Use the hashtag Sunshine Economy with the handle at WLRN. This is the Sunshine Economy. Grow the agriculture industry in South Florida. And still to come, the Mexican side of the tomato trade war. This is the Sunshine Economy. Grow the agriculture industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. Even though the tomato is scientifically a fruit, legally in the United States, it is considered a vegetable, thanks to an 1893 Supreme Court case. Now, that case was over import tariffs on vegetables. So the High Court decided that the tomato, in the U.S. at least, legally speaking, is a vegetable. So fast forward 120 years, and there are still fights over the red fruit, scientifically speaking. Thanks to that Supreme Court legal definition in Florida, among vegetable crops, the tomato is king, and it certainly is king in South Florida. Sunshine State growers have been fighting against imported Mexican tomatoes for more than a decade, claiming the Mexican tomato is sold below cost, hurts the profits of Florida's agriculture industry. Joining us now is Martin Lay, president of Fresh Evolution Produce and a spokesman for Mexico tomato growers. He joins us from Nogales, Arizona. Martin, welcome to the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. How important is the U.S. market to Mexican tomato farmers?
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me to your show. The Mexico industry has evolved over the years to really take and grow beyond its own needs. And it has focused into the North American market, both in the U.S. and in Canada. So as a result, those markets are extremely important, and we have continued to stay focused at servicing the consumers in those three countries.
Right now, are the amount of tomatoes sent to the U.S. and Canada greater from Mexico than the amount of tomatoes that are sold and grown in Mexico?
It depends on the time of the year. In the winter time, yes, because a lot of the production and a lot of the needs are in the U.S. much greater than what the U.S. can supply or produce. And Canada is also in light production. So Mexico exports a significant portion of its production in the winter time. In the summertime, that percentage changes in Mexico. Volume reduces quite a bit.
And the wintertime is really when the South Florida grower is impacted, because that is our tomato growing season here in South Florida as well. This fight has been going on over the price of Mexican tomatoes in the U.S. since 1996. Are Mexican growers dumping cheap tomatoes on the U.S. market, Martin?
No, there has been some claims, and there has been an investigation that started in 1996. The Department of Commerce went ahead and did some preliminary calculations, and on the preliminary numbers, they determined that there was a margin of 17.6. That number still needs to go and be verified and be confirmed or proven. We didn't get into that phase of the investigation because we opted to enter into a suspension agreement with the Department of Commerce.
So the U.S. government back in 1996 decided that Mexican growers were selling tomatoes at 17% below the cost of production, but that investigation into that difference was suspended because the government decided to agree to allow your Mexican growers to sell tomatoes at a certain price. Currently, that price is 31 cents per pound.
Correct. And that price went up from 21.69 cents a pound. It was previously, and both the U.S. government and Mexico agreed that it was a better alternative to go forward with that because it gave it was a better solution for everybody as a whole. As you know, the U.S. government has to keep an eye and have to be thinking about its industries as well as its citizens.
Right.
So overall, it's a great solution.
And I want to ask you about resolving this trade war over the tomato that's been ongoing now since 1996 in a moment. 31 cents per pound, that floor number, that's the minimum charge that your growers in Mexico can sell their tomatoes wholesale into the United States. What's their cost of production? Do you know?
The cost of production in Mexico varies because you have a very wide type of production. You have from open field production, you have very high sophisticated levels of production. Also, you have to keep in mind that in Mexico, there is many, many types of tomatoes that are grown in there. It's not just one type,
sure,
two types of tomatoes.
Yeah.
Usually in the United States, you see a very limited assortment of tomatoes. So when you go into a dumping investigation, the dumping investigation tries to give a brush stroke to the entire industry. So in Mexico, he's very diverse and very wide.
Well, Martin Lay is with us, who is a spokesman for the Mexico tomato growers. Martin, you're absolutely right. Lots of varieties out there, lots of different costs of production for individual growers and farms in Mexico. But the Commerce Department agreement that was signed most recently back in March has just four designations for Mexican tomatoes, and the so-called open field tomato is 31 cents per pound. So I guess the question is, for your industry, do you know what the average cost of production in Mexico for an open field tomato is?
Again, it's hard to give you just one number because you have not only different methods of production, but growing areas that are very, very diverse between different countries, different areas of Mexico. We have the privilege of having great weather conditions in different times of the year, so we can produce year-round in different types of tomatoes,
sure,
in a very cost-effective way. So what I can tell you is that the prices that we are selling, and for us, and I think that is very important, we have been talking and dedicating a lot of time to talk about cost, but I think that when you look at the way that you can grow a business and the way that you can have success going forward into a business that you have to maintain is by looking for ways to be able to produce what the consumer wants and what is going to be able to give you a better return,
yeah,
for the product. So we have, and you were talking earlier about NAFTA and the impact. I think since NAFTA was created, it really has been a trigger to transform the industry because it has allowed Mexico to apply technology, to apply equipment, and to put it to work at giving better results in terms of efficiencies, mm-hmm, and in terms of the type of tomatoes that we can grow.
We're talking
what has happened is that we have actually completely transformed our industry, where we are providing tomatoes to the U.S. market, to the Canadian market, to the Mexican market that were not offered before.
Sure.
High flavor, very different appearances, different colors, and the consumers are responding very well. Over the years, we have had significant increase at the prices that we are obtaining for tomatoes grown in Mexico than what we were obtaining back in the beginning of the implementation of NAFTA.
Martin, just in our final moments here on the Sunshine Economy, couldn't you anticipate a permanent resolution to end this trade war once and for all in the years ahead, or will it continue with this every few years setting a minimum price?
We really hope that we can come into resolution. We have found that over the last 16 years, and I'll recall to that this dispute, and you were saying earlier in the show that legally is a vegetable, but it's truly fruit. I think we are getting used to into this concept of legally Mexico is accused of dumping, but it's not really. And the consumer is responding very well to what we're offering to them. The buyers, the retailers are coming here. And I want to mention one very important component here. A lot of times people think about Mexico as a import and as somebody that is coming here and causing some trouble in the U.S. market. But it's very important that about 70 cents out of every dollar that is spent in the U.S. on Mexican tomatoes go to businesses and workers in the U.S.
That's considering the retail price versus the cost of production. Martin, we have to leave it there. Martin Lay, along with us, president of Fresh Evolution Produce, spokesman for Mexico tomato growers, with us here on the Sunshine Economy. Still to come, South Florida farmer squeezing in with the rest of us.
We like to say we farm between the alligators and the deep blue sea.
This is the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Today's agriculture industry in Miami-Dade County is only three-quarters the size it was just 20 years ago, at least measured in acres. But measured in dollars of economic impact, the industry actually has more than doubled over that same two decades. Farmers for generations have been pinched between the Everglades and the ever-growing demand for land to develop. One answer has been the Urban Development Boundary, so-called the UDB, designed to keep sprawl at bay. It was implemented back in 1983, and there have been some changes. A report from the Environmental Protection Agency back in 2012 warned agricultural land outside the boundary was dwindling, warning, quote, "This gradual loss of farmland is threatening the critical mass required to sustain agricultural operations," end quote. So I took two road trips, the first with Miami-Dade County Agriculture Manager Charles LePrade, well outside the line. So we're traveling west here on Biscayne, southwest 288th Street, and turning south now, yeah, on Country Club Drive or southwest 202nd Avenue. On our left here, we've got pretty good-sized acreage, Charles, that's waiting to be planted.
It is. They've gone in and they've dissed the field and gotten rid of the weeds as they've cut it a couple of times. Turned everything over, and they'll be getting ready to plant that in the next couple of days, actually.
And it'll be probably squash, some vegetables, wouldn't it?
That is either going to be tomatoes or green beans or squash. It'll be one of the three.
How important is that vegetable crop for the South Florida ag industry?
Well, green beans were number one in the country, so it's not too shabby. Industry-wide, we do, between all sectors, about $700 million in sales a year, which is equal to about $2.7 billion economic impact when you do all the multipliers of everything. And that puts us at number two in the county, in the state. As far as counties go, we're number 18 in the country for the values of crops sold. That's pretty significant when you look at us being such an urbanized county and our location. But it's our location that allows us to do that because we can farm something year-round. There is always crop available.
Charles, let me ask you about this pinching of the space that growers have to make a livelihood and make an economic impact.
There's a limitation on density on the rural side of that line, and that's where we happen to be today. And it's limited to one house on 5 acres, unless it was platted prior to 1972. So you do have that limitation that does pull off some of the stress, but it's a double-edged sword. You can have property on one side of the line that's worth $150,000 an acre, and 20 feet away it's worth $30,000 an acre. That was a great wealth divide when it was put in. and most of the people that were on either side were farmers of one type or another. And, you know, farmers, especially if you look at what we've been through the past 5-6 years with the recession, equity is very important. So it is a double-edged sword where, you know, nobody wants to see the paving over, but you have to have some value to borrow when times are tough.
Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Good, how you doing?
Good, Tom? Come on in.
It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too. Let me clean up my passenger side mess here.
Thanks for picking me up.
Oh, no problem at all.
Well, to get a different tour a day later, I picked up Jeff Onstad at FIU, where he's an assistant professor of geography studying land use, including the Miami-Dade County Urban Development Boundary. So we got in the car and headed west on Tamiami.
So much of South Florida industry is tied one way, shape, or form to real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And farmers really need that equity on land when
right.
times get tough. The boundary can really impact the value of those land prices if you're on the rural side of the boundary.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just looking into that question and looking into my data, and I discovered that I tried to find two parcels that were as close together as possible that were both in agriculture, and this dates from 2011. So I found one parcel that was row and field crop land inside the urban development boundary in 2011. And that was valued by the appraiser's office at around $770,000 an acre. About a half mile away on the outside of the urban development boundary, I found another parcel, about 28 acres, which was valued. These are just the land values, not the improvement values and
right.
not the assessed values,
because
oftentimes there's an agricultural exemption. But that land was valued at $35,000.
From 770,000 an acre
to 35,000
an acre.
Yeah.
Less than 10%.
Yeah, and
wow.
that was about a half mile away.
Wow.
So we have these newly arrived suburbanites in these areas and perhaps not fully aware of what it's like to live next to a working farm. It can be loud. They can be smelly.
Yeah.
They might be applying pesticides. So this causes a lot of conflict. But still, a lot of times farmers see the writing on the wall and there might be other factors, and they think maybe now it's time to go.
Yeah.
And so maybe before there was four farms adjacent to each other, then three, then two, then one. It gets harder and harder to keep up. We're looking for 157 signal.
Okay, will I be going north or south?
Actually, as soon as we hit 157, the UDB continues on our left,
okay.
but it won't be on our right. Orchards and row and field cropland, you know, are major food production. Lots of fruits, lots of vegetables. Within the urban development boundary, the main threat to them has been development, right? So a lot of single family homes, other commercial industries, and that's been the main loss there. But outside the urban development boundary, there's been two other less obvious losses. Well, one...
152nd, what are we looking for?
I believe it's 157.
157.
Yeah. And I can actually get my handy computer out.
No, we'll get that.
Okay.
So the losses inside?
Yeah, the losses inside are, the main losses are to development. But outside the UDB, there have been two other kinds of losses to food production, I should say. The first is acquisition by state and federal agencies of large, large parcels of farmland in the western part of the county buffering the Everglades.
We're going south now on 157th Avenue.
Uh-huh.
We just turned off of Tamiami Trail. You are struck by, on one hand, you know, to our east in this instance, you know, it's home after home after home, single family homes. They're probably 10 feet apart. And on our right, which would be to our west, is just brushland. It's not agriculture land, because this is... it's all pretty wet, right by a canal and some of the other areas here. But clearly, no development.
No development.
It's we've driven acre after acre of brushland, hammock oaks, some pine,
mm-hmm.
and that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest also that, you know, these houses right here are actually higher in value because they're right on the boundary. You know, part of the American dream, right, is you want to build your dream home somewhere out, you know, in the woods, and then don't want anyone else to come out there.
Well,
if you build a house right here, this view will remain unobstructed if we believe that the urban development boundary will never move.
So we're south now on 162nd Avenue. We're going to turn west onto Miller, southwest 56th Street, and see if we can pick up the boundary again, because we've obviously driven inside the urban development boundary here in Miami-Dade.
Yeah.
And it'll probably be pretty obvious once we find the boundary, if we do, here on 56th.
Mm-hmm. This phenomena isn't necessarily a Miami thing. It's an American thing, our this sort of suburban sprawl and our consumption of farmland. It's also important to point out that the farmland that gets consumed the quickest tends to be the best farmland we have. More remote areas tend to be more likely to be, you know, pasture lands and things like that. So, as this is happening across the United States, we're losing a lot of fruits and vegetables, which tend to be very close to metropolitan areas.
So if I had to guess, what are we looking at straight
ahead? I think
ahead
we're back.
Here?
I think we found it again.
Corner of 167th Avenue and 56th Street.
Yeah, we kind of dead-ended here.
We've got a T intersection, and I think we're looking straight at the boundary.
I think you're right.
Let's pull on over and take some pictures.
Okay.
Jeff Onstadt from FIU, as we're going over some bumps in the road there on our tour of the dividing line between urban and rural South Florida. You can actually see some pictures on our web chat and look at our route at WLRN.org under the Sunshine Economy tab. Still to come, getting pinched by prices and regulations.
As much as I'd want my son to be a farmer, as much as I do, is about the same amount I don't want him to be a farmer, because it's just hard.
This is the Sunshine Economy. Grow the agriculture industry in South Florida. I'm Tom Hudson. In Palm Beach County, the business is dominated by one crop, sugarcane. About 80% of Florida-grown sugarcane comes from Palm Beach County. In Broward County, the cash crop is concentrated in the nursery business. But in Miami-Dade County, it's a much more diversified mix. Vegetable row crops like beans, zucchini, even corn, tropical fruit like mangoes and avocados, and nurseries growing everything from houseplants to palm trees.
My name is Margie Pekarski. I'm the owner-operator of Bee Heaven Farm, and I've been growing here since 1995. Well, we are a small family farm, very diversified. We have 5 acres. About 1.5 acres of that is planted in vegetables, herbs, edible flowers. About another 2 acres is the grove of fruit trees, mainly avocados. And then the rest is our homestead. We live on the property. So we're just wrapping up our avocado season, and we're getting ready to start planting.
How has the avocado season been this year? How's the harvest?
You know, the harvest was much bigger than other years. For us, the market was the converse of that. We didn't sell as much as we had been. As an organic avocado grower, we actually now have more competition, a fact of which I am happy, but it does affect me.
So I imagine prices were impacted. Prices down from last year?
In the case of the organic growers, the prices are not really down so much as that there is so much more availability and the market is limited.
Hmm.
So we aren't able to sell as much.
So does that mean that you've got fruit ready to go but not finding buyers?
My fruit is just about finished, my harvest. I have an early variety of avocados, and we did have some fruit sitting on the ground, rotting away. We did sell most of it.
The fruit on the ground represents money lost, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
How much? Any idea?
Maybe between 20% and 25% this year of our crop.
That sounds pretty big.
Yeah. Like I said, we have more organic growers, so I have mixed feelings about that.
Yeah.
Yes, it affects me personally, but one thing that I have always done here is try to encourage more organic growers.
Margie, as somebody who has seen the South Florida ag industry firsthand, how would you describe where it is today and where it's been, and where do you think it's going?
In a sense, it's going full circle back to what it was when things were smaller. People were more personally involved. I think we went through a phase where mechanization was everything and chemistry was the best thing that could happen. And I think we're getting a bit away from that. We're beginning to realize some of the consequences of large monocultures and the potential threats. I think that's a hopeful sign because I think that helps us become a stronger industry down here. We become more resilient, more able to handle whatever nature's throwing at us.
Further along the food chain is Diego Rodriguez. He has run Rodriguez Grove Services since 1977, packing avocados and mangoes. His concern is how stiffer food safety regulations will cost his business.
And the record keeping is really what's going to be incredible because they start with the premise that if it's not documented, it didn't occur. So you have to not only keep track of, clean everything, but you have to keep track of who clean it, when they clean it, what they clean it, and it just goes on and on. I mean, the people in the packing line have to wear hairnets, they have to wear gloves, they have to wash their hands. Well, for example, I thought I was being very proactive in my bathroom in the packing house. I put a blower so that they wouldn't have to.
A hand blower.
Yeah. So now she told me, no, don't use that because that blows germs into the packing line.
You've been operating your packing plant since the late 1970s. Recently, we've seen E. coli scares, salmonella scares on the part of fruit and vegetables grown here in the United States, not here necessarily in Dade County. So on one hand, I suppose you can understand the regulatory response to some of that, but what's the impact on your business and the impact on your ability to remain a vital ongoing enterprise?
Well, this E. coli thing is very personal to me because 3 years ago my daughter almost died from E. coli 0157 strain. She was a month in the South Miami Hospital, and every day she had to have the dialysis and then plasma exchange. And I realize all that, and I think that some of the issues are good, but some of the other issues are impossible to carry out.
Such as?
Well, for example, technically you have to have a scout in front of your picking crew to see if there's any trees that a bird has defecated on, and then you have to flag that tree and you can't pick the fruit. Then you go to a Bayside and you see all those birds flying around the restaurants, and it has to be some reasonable regulations.
I met Mark Wilson in one of his loading docks at Greendale Nursery, part of his 40-acre operation, selling all kinds of plants up and down the East Coast and into the Midwest. He would like to see the debate over undocumented workers settled in a way that helps agriculture.
If we have a body of people that are already here, we should try to kind of regularize it or normalize their status so they can feel a part of the community. They can also contribute to the funding of some of the services that invariably they use. And that would be one of the things that would be critical in terms of the viability of this industry.
How big is your workforce here when you're at peak season?
At peak season, we're over 50 employees. Now it's the low season, we're at about 37. That is really a concern to us, having a viable workforce that can be here to harvest the crops.
Are you seeing the current debate over immigration impacting your ability to hire the types of people that you need to hire for the job to be able to have the operating structure and the cost structure that you have?
Well, agriculture as a whole has been the easiest method of which we can assimilate this large group of people. One of the things that I must say I'm a little upset with is when they talk about undocumented workers, they primarily steer at the farming community and say, hey, those are the people that have caused this issue. And I would say, number one, I don't think agriculture caused that issue. People come here because they're looking for a better life or for whatever reason or political persecution. Number two, The hospitality industry also has a huge amount of this group of people, as well as the construction industry.
The other point that is made in the immigration debate is even the industries that you mentioned, especially agriculture and hospitality, are generally lower paying industries, and that these are jobs that are being taken by immigrants, illegal or otherwise, that Americans haven't been able to fulfill. Have you experienced that?
It's a level entry job. You don't need much skill. I don't believe that someone that has been born and raised in this country would be interested in this type of level entry job. So, you know, I disagree when people say that these folks are stealing jobs.
Almost to Everglades National Park is SNL Beans, the largest vegetable grower in the area. Sal Finocchiaro and his brother have been farming here since their dad started in the late 1960s.
Just really, really tough anymore. Everything, there's just a lot of added expense you have now, like with food safety, and just all the costs are going up, and our produce is really the same price as it was 20, 25 years ago.
So how do you go about influencing that on the price side to try to make up for some of that increased cost structure that you've experienced over the past several years?
We don't. We just take whatever you can get, really, because there's, and not really being mean to a company like Walmart, but they're huge. What are you going to say to them? Nothing, you know. They're huge, Walmart. There's big chain stores, you know, like Publix, Winn-Dixie, all these guys, you know. They kind of mandate what you're going
to
get.
And you feel you kind of have to do business with them because of their size and their reach? You got to sell your beans and your zucchinis to them?
Well, you almost have to. You have to have a certain percentage of chain store business, because if you don't, there's the big possibility of dealing with smaller folks that aren't going to pay you.
What's the next generation of farming look like, do you think, here in South Florida?
I don't know. It's just going to get harder and harder. I really, as much as I'd want my son to be a farmer, as much as I do, is about the same amount I don't want him to be a farmer, because it's just hard. It's a lot of work just to, like, our goal is to break even. And it's a lot of work to come out here every single day to just break even.
Sal Finocchiaro of SNL Beans in South Dade County, part of the agriculture industry in the Sunshine State. Still to come on the program, where agriculture commerce meets the consumer. We go in the kitchen.
Oh my goodness, that's beautiful. Look at this. It's very nice. And it's ripe. I'm so pleased.
I did good at the grocery store.
You sure did.
This is the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson. We take the taste challenge now. Local products facing off against ingredients from all over the hemisphere. This being football season, what better dish to use than guacamole? I asked Linda Gassenheimer to help out. I bought the ingredients. She did the preparation. So as you get to chopping here, let me describe what we've got, our ingredients. We're going to make two guacamoles, and we've got ingredients that are Florida-based, as best we can tell, and we have ingredients that are coming from every place else. We've got a red onion from North Carolina, we've got a Canadian red tomato, and we have two Mexican Hass avocados and a jalapeno whose origins are yet to be determined, although it looks pretty good.
We're going to have a really nice guacamole. The avocados are ripe and ready to go.
You just cut into the Hass here, taking the pit out. What do you make of this Hass out of Mexico? Does it look good?
It looks good. It's delicious. It has wonderful flavor. If you want to make yourself really happy, to know that the Florida ones have fewer calories.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just cutting them into little cubes like that. Let's put this into the bowl.
Now, we're cutting into our Canadian tomato. Of course, the tomato season here in Florida runs from January through April, so we had to go to Canada to get this tomato to come into Florida for prime tailgating guacamole season. Tomato looks pretty good, firm, but not too firm.
It's good. Let me see. I'm tasting it.
The verdict?
It has some flavor.
Oh, if that's better than no flavor.
Yes,
yeah.
I'm very surprised. And now I'm going to put a little onion in. Oh, I have my jalapeno pepper.
It's a jalapeno of questionable origin, and we just say questionable because it wasn't labeled. We don't know where it's from.
And if people want to know where their food is from, it is the law. They have to tell you.
But who do you ask?
Well, that's a problem.
Yeah, that's the problem.
That is a problem. Now, the heat's up to you, okay?
Turn it up.
Turn it up?
Turn it up.
Turn up the heat? So, have I forgotten anything? Everything's
garlic.
In there?
Do you want some garlic?
Oh, the garlic, yeah.
We did bring some garlic.
Okay,
we did find some garlic. Let me go over here and grab it. This was garlic that is packed in Orlando. So we're going to break one of our rules here a little bit and put a little bit of Florida ingredients into our non-Florida guacamole.
That's no, yeah.
So here we are now. That's it.
All right, scoop that and mix that up together. That looks great. So here we go. This is our non-Florida guacamole. Mexican Hass avocados, Canadian tomato, North Carolina red onion,
right,
and a jalapeno of unknown origin, and California cilantro.
Boy, it just got to me.
Oh, we forgot our Mexican lime.
Squeeze that lime juice in there.
Oh, yeah.
So good. You know what it's missing? It's missing my tasting.
And the verdict?
Oh, my God, that's delicious. Well, of course, what did I expect, right?
All right, let's go and do our Florida-based guacamole. There's the Florida avocado.
It's larger, and I'm going to give us... Oh, my goodness, that's beautiful. Look at this. It's very nice. And it's ripe. I'm so pleased.
I did good at the grocery store.
You sure did.
All right, we're putting our Florida avocado into our mixing bowl here. And because it's out of season, couldn't find Florida tomatoes in the grocery store. So what we did, Linda,
yes,
let me go over here to the fridge and open it up.
Okay.
I was able to successfully find some Florida packed and distributed fresh salsa. And with you in mind, this one was mild-mannered.
And would you like to open that for me? I mean,
I'll get
that,
it.
Is that as much as you're doing?
That's
in
as
the
much as I'll
now?
Do. I will open up the pre-made Florida packed salsa here. And get the factory seal off of it. There we go. It does look pretty good.
I'm going to spoon it out and leave some of the liquid in. Now that's, I've just put some in, and I'm going to stir it around, and that makes a very pretty guacamole because you still got the red and the yellow,
mm-hmm,
the very yellow and green avocado. I think we're going to use more.
So we've got our Florida-made guacamole here, which is a Dade County Florida avocado and Florida Gulf Coast-packed salsa.
Okay.
The verdict?
That is really good. I'm really delighted.
This is where the commerce of agribusiness really meets the consumer. These two guacamoles, one used with out-of-state ingredients, one used with, as best we could, in-state ingredients. Different, but from the lips of Linda Gassenheimer, both delicious.
But, well, I made them. Okay.
Now, those are tortilla chips from Texas that we had to use for the tasting. There is a picture of the two guacamoles on our web chat at WLRN.org. The Florida-only ingredients on the left. And for the record, I did wash the dishes after Linda made both guacamoles here for the Sunshine Economy. Plenty of conversation online at WLRN.org. It's not often we think of the effort and the people behind what we eat. For many of us, it's just grabbing the food. But if it's true that we are what we eat, then our agricultural economy is part of us. This is the Sunshine Economy. Thanks for listening.
Everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season turn.